Welcome to the Whiskey and Wisdom Podcast, coming to you from the Cargo District Recording Studios in Wilmington, North Carolina, where we discuss the most fascinating topics of life. I'm Tyler Yaw with my co-host, Chris Kelly, and each week we interview a special guest to learn how they acquired their wisdom over a glass of whiskey. So sit back, pour yourself a glass, and enjoy Whiskey and Wisdom.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Whiskey and Wisdom Podcast. This is your co-host, Tyler Yaw, and I am here with
Chris Kellum.
And our special guest for this evening is
Aaron Goss from Carolina Malt House.
Appreciate it so much for stopping by today.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me down.
I'm so excited. I have like six questions already.
Chris came in and he goes, "I'm so excited. I have so many questions." And I was like, "Oh, this is perfect then." So today, instead of whiskey, we are actually going to be drinking Sneaky Goose from Wilmington Brewing Company, which actually has some of your malt in it, right?
Right. And I told you guys, I actually kind of meant to bring a different beer that was a little more malt forward. This one is a West Coast IPA, so very hoppy. But the one that had that was more malt forward with our malt in it sold out too quickly, so I couldn't get my hands on any.
That's a very good problem to have then.
But this one's still good. Yeah. It's got our malt in it, but just a little more hop forward, a little harder to taste the malt coming through.
Yeah, that's perfect. Let's try it.
Cheers. Cheers. I don't want to splash.
That's pretty good beer. It is very hoppy.
Yeah. So this is a Sneaky Goose from Wilmington Brewing.
Are you a little Sneaky Goose?
West Coast style Imperial IPA.
Yes.
Yeah. I wish John had been there. I would have asked him why he named it Sneaky Goose.
Right, yeah. We'll have to bring him on sometime then and find out the story behind that.
The origins.
Yeah, the origin story.
I always forget to ask those questions. For those who actually care about our alcohol that we drink, this one is, like you said, from Wilmington Brewing Company. It's very interesting because it's a double IPA. It also has the fancy name of a West Coast style Imperial IPA. So flavor-wise, it's a little bit different. It is 9.4%. That's pretty high for a beer.
Just like a standard West Coast IPA.
And it's, I mean, it's just a traditional IPA. I think you'd like it. I mean, it's not heavy.
No.
It's not super light. It's right in between. It'd be a good beer for, to me, I would drink it probably like in that weird summertime when it gets warmer, but it's not like hot out.
Yeah.
Or like a summer night.
Finally starting to get Chris's like seasonal type of drinking style down, because there's certain things that he's only going to drink during certain times of the year. So
It allows me to lengthen the time that I have this alcohol.
That's true.
Yep. Go for like the porters and stouts more in the wintertime.
Yes.
Yeah. It's good springtime, fall beer. And then summertime, maybe you go for like a nice light beer.
Yeah.
Right. And so I do have to say, we do appreciate you coming out here, meeting us in person, because you did drive all the way in from...
Well, Cleveland, North Carolina.
Cleveland, North Carolina. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Which, if you don't know where that is, it's between Salisbury and Statesville. So I grew up in Salisbury, built the malt house near where I grew up.
Okay.
And then now I live closer to Statesville.
Okay.
Yeah. Nice area. Real pretty.
Salisbury. Yeah. Did you know we had a Cleveland?
Not until I met Aaron a couple weeks ago.
Oh, okay. I was like, Cleveland too?
Yeah. That's, I mean, I'm not surprised you haven't heard of it. Yeah. It's a small town, but we're putting it on the map.
Okay. Exactly.
Yeah. Us. And then they have like it used to be a Freightliner truck manufacturer. I think now it's owned by Daimler Chrysler.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Really big plant there for making big highway trucks.
Oh, wow. Good to know. So how'd you get into the malt business?
Well, so it goes back to law school when my time was worth nothing. And so I started brewing beer and progressed from kit beer to buying malt from the malt from the homebrew store.
Right.
And then took the additional step because I'm from Salisbury, which is, I mean, Cleveland is kind of right in the middle of North Carolina's grain belt.
Right.
But Salisbury's right there, too. So, I mean, I grew up with a bunch of kids whose dads were small grains farmers.
Oh, wow.
And so I took that additional step of getting some barley, malting it at home, making beer from that. And it was really good. Not only does the freshness matter, but like if you're familiar with wine, they have this concept of terroir, mm-hmm. but the same thing actually applies to beer. There's a really interesting study done by MillerCoors back in 78, 79 that kind of mm-hmm. really confirmed that. But the Carolinas do have just unique growing conditions that creates a kind of a unique flavor in the beer. So, yeah, not just the freshness and the attention to the process that we can give it, but the terroir really made for some good beer. So I got married in 2013. I made all the beer for my wedding. It was
that's so cool.
Yeah, 9 kegs of beer. And it was all gone at the end of the wedding weekend.
Nice.
And I don't know if either of you have ever gotten married.
Yeah, both of us.
Okay, yeah. So when you get married, you notice that like the price is 4 times what it would be. Like you're renting a tent for your company event, the price is X. You get married, yes. It's X times 4. So
Yeah. Anyway,
it was cheaper for me, cheaper than renting glassware to buy a whole pallet of pint glasses from China. So I got my import license, brought in a whole pallet of pint glasses. It was free to put a logo on them.
So, oh, that's awesome.
So at my wedding, I had people drinking out of these Goss Brewing Company pint glasses and really enjoying this locally grown beer. And it was actually my friend's mom came up to my mom and she said, "Hey, is Aaron thinking of starting a brewery? Because if so, this is really good beer and I want to invest." And,
oh, wow.
So I got to talk to her and her son later about the idea. And I kind of explained, well, it's maybe not so much the brewing process as the quality of the ingredients that made it good beer. Mm-hmm. And I explained what I really wanted to do was open a malting operation so that other breweries could make locally grown beer.
Right.
And, but yeah, her son actually ended up being my business partner in starting the thing. And,
oh, wow.
Nice.
Yeah. I plowed in a bunch of my savings from practicing law.
Yeah.
And got a couple more people on board and started building the malt house.
So, that's really neat. So you said that you were malting the barley. So what is the malting process?
So to make it very simple, and this is something that people have been doing since at least 2500 BC, you hydrate the barley, so get it wet, mm-hmm. and then let it sit, so let it germinate, and then you dry it out. So it's ready to go into beer. Very early beer makers, it seems like they probably skipped the drying it out phase, and then they just kind of immediately went into the mashing phase.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, modern malting, there's that kilning step, which makes it taste better, and then also makes it shelf stable, so you can have one malt house serving a large geographical area, and you've got this relatively shelf stable product that's ready to be made into beer at any time.
Wow.
So,
okay. But yeah.
So I like to go backwards to go forwards.
Oh, sure.
Law school? Where'd you go to school at?
So for law school, I went to Wake Forest University.
Okay.
Yeah. But they had a great all MBA program. So
just because
randomly,
you told me a little part of this story, when did you graduate originally, age-wise?
I never graduated high school.
Right.
And then I did graduate from college, but I was 16 years old at the time. So
I knew Chris's mind was like going to get blown.
You're smart.
Well, I test well.
So you skipped high school for the most part.
Yep. Yeah. My parents did have me go back for like one semester after college just to see what it was like. So, but I didn't graduate. So,
okay.
Yeah, and that never did. And it was really funny after I graduated law school, they have like this bar interview.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you sit in a room with a couple of attorneys. And I went in the room and they said, well, you know, we found a mistake on your bar application. You forgot to write down your high school. You know, you're not going to be sloppy with paperwork like this when you're an attorney. Like, that's actually not a mistake, sirs.
Excuse me.
So I just got to spend 10 minutes in there kind of, you know, they're just, wow, what was that like? And I just got to tell some stories from being 12 years old in college.
That's pretty cool. So how'd that process look like getting into college without finishing high school?
Well, so I went to public school first mm-hmm. through sixth grade. And then in sixth grade, I was just kind of had this private war with my English teacher. Like I corrected mm-hmm. her one time at the start of the year and then she just never got over it.
Yeah.
And I mean, so many things. I won the spelling bee and she was like, I bet you studied that word list I gave you to win the spelling bee. I said, well, actually, I think this class has been a waste of my time. And my mother agrees. And anyway, so got sent to the principal's office. But the nice thing about that, my mom let me homeschool the next year.
Okay.
And I was so grateful to be out of school that I got through a whole high school curriculum worth of textbooks by December.
Oh, my God.
And then in North Carolina, they have you take the SAT in seventh grade just to kind of see how you do. And so that would have been like my seventh grade year. I took it and I did really well on it. close to the maximum score you could get at the time.
Wow.
And then it started out as just taking like some enrichment courses at the college. I think mom was kind of thinking like, well, you know, sometimes kids in high school will take like college level courses like as an enrichment. Yeah. So she talked to the local college. They let me come in for that. So I took like 12 hours the first semester. Mm-hmm. And then I think the next year I was up to taking like 26 hours a semester.
Oh, wow.
And I just took courses on everything they had. I was curious. Yeah. So, and after 3.5 years, I just happened to have enough credits in computer science for a major. So I went ahead and walked.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So you went from computer science into law then?
Yeah. So I was a computer programmer for 8 years. Yeah. Started out working for a Food Lion grocery store.
Okay.
Made a produce quoting application, worked on their first website, like the store locator, and made this really, I don't think it ever made it on the website, but I made this really fun little game where you controlled a bagger and you could like move him side to side along the bottom of the screen, like Galaga.
Yeah.
And you would have to catch falling groceries. And so, you know, like the candy bar was worth 5 points. The broccoli was worth like 50.
Oh, of course.
And then if you got the MVP card, that was 500, you know, that was like winning the lot. But anyway, yeah. But I did that for a couple of years, kind of started my own little computer repair business, ended up working for a company in Raleigh that made a integrated development environment for COBOL, PL1, some of the older languages.
Okay.
They were helping people get ready for Y2K. And then, so that's kind of how they got their foot in the door. And then I worked with them after the Y2K changeover to just helping refine the product. And then, so did that for a little while. And then when I was the right age to go to graduate school, I took the LSAT, the GMAT, the MCAT, and I did on the LSAT and the GMAT, you know, and Wake Forest seemed like a good place to go.
So, right. When I was the age that I could apply to grad school. Right. I've already done a whole life. I do something different.
Then I practiced law for 5 years after that. And then that was when the malt thing really started to seem like a good idea.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. So when you were kind of practicing law then, were you just kind of getting bored with the law part? And you're just like, you know what, this would be so much more fun to go into malt? Because it's kind of a weird kind of transition, I guess you could say, right?
Well, I got my MBA at the same time as my law degree. So I kind of had an idea that I want to get into business. You know, the practicing law was really good for paying off law school.
That's what they say.
Good point.
But it was kind of two things happening at once. So my big cases when I was an attorney were like class action cases. Payday lending is illegal in North Carolina, but a bunch of people continued making payday loans even after it became illegal. So class action law, very good way to handle that. But then a Supreme Court decision came down that kind of knocked out that branch of practice. And then at the same time, the malting thing really seemed like a good idea. I started, after I got that positive feedback, I started looking into it a little bit more closely. I saw there were, I think at the time there were 118 breweries in the state and 54 permits pending, something like that. Mm-hmm. Wow. And then I looked at the website again, like just maybe a month later, and it was already up to 127 breweries and like 70 permits pending. And I thought, wow, you know, a bunch of people are really getting into this. Now we have over 300 breweries in North Carolina. And it's just really been exciting to be a part of it.
Yeah. So from what I understand too, then right in the malting world, there's pretty much like just one main place that the overwhelming majority of beers get their malt from. Is that right?
Well, so there are European malting operations. So the UK has, 6 to 8 large malting operations. Germany has Weyermann Malt and a few others. And then in the US, when Prohibition knocked out the beer industry, it also knocked out the malt industry.
That
makes sense.
I mean, my history could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that pre-Prohibition, there were like 15 malt houses in North Carolina, and Prohibition knocked that out. And then after Prohibition, when everything was rebuilding, it was also kind of that industrialization era. Mm-hmm. And so, like, if you wanted to rebuild beer in the U.S., it was like, okay, where do we go to do this big? And so it's like, okay, well, north Midwestern grain fields, we can grow all the barley we could possibly need up there. And so they go there, they build the malt houses and the breweries there. And that's kind of the state of beer for the next 60, 70 years until you see this, you see the craft breweries popping up and then kind of following after that, the craft malt houses are coming in.
That's really neat. What makes that kind of Salisbury area perfect for barley.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thank you for our sponsor, the Leland Brewing Company, right over the bridge in Leland Township. Definitely check them out. It's a nice local spot with local beers that they're making on site, as well as some that aren't from the area. It is an amazing family-friendly location, and it's really nice. They got some greenery out back, as well as some nice food trucks that pop up every now and then. So give them a check out. Tell them that Whiskey and Wisdom sent you.
Well, a lot of factors. One big one is just the timing of rainfall. But one nice thing we have going for us is just the prevailing wind pattern combined with Lake Norman creates kind of this just sheltered area where we don't get rain when we don't want rain. We do get rain when we do want rain.
Nice.
And that it makes for some really good small grains.
Yeah. So definitely not the coast then where we just get rain all of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had a couple of farmers out this way try to grow malting barley for us. Mm-hmm. And I've had a couple of them where who don't seem to be able to hit the quality, but recently we've been working with a guy named Tommy Wheeler out this way, Tidewater Grain, and whatever he's doing, he seems to have it figured out. He's given us some really great quality from the coastal plains.
So you're talking about something that hits your quality standards. I'm assuming you guys have like higher standards than just like anything coming in.
Oh yeah.
What is the flavor difference though?
Well, the flavor difference, it's a little bit tough to put your finger on. Yeah. It's like trying to explain to somebody the difference between fresh bread and Wonder Bread. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's you know, how do you explain that? It's just, well,
right. You taste it.
Just go taste some, you know, and try it out. But the flavor difference, I would say, for our product is twofold. So that not only is there the freshness that comes from being local, but also there is that notion of terroir, which is just the slightly different soil composition, the soil microbe population, the rainfall, the hours of sunshine, just all of that goes into kind of that, the French concept of terroir that's been applied to wine for years and years, but same thing applies to barley.
That's neat.
So go ahead. Oh,
no, I was just going to talk a little bit more about that Miller Coors study.
Yeah.
Back in 78 and 79, Miller Coors did this big study. They took seven different growing areas, and all of this was just growing areas around that, like Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado area.
Okay.
But they grew the same variety of barley in those areas and then selected for, like, there are roughly eight standard quality checks you do on inbound barley.
Mm-hmm.
And so they checked for barley that was similar in plumpness, protein level, things like that, to just try to get as homogeneous a sample from those disparate growing areas as they could, kept the growing areas segregated, made beer according to the same brewing schedule, and then had their drinkability panel taste the difference in drinkability and rate it. So 1978, they do this, they come up, and we'll just say that these eight growing areas were ranked A, B, C, D, E, F, G.
Okay.
Yeah. Same thing the next year. And this year, the growing areas are ranked, I think it was like A, B, C, D, F, E, G, something like that.
Okay.
So a very, very similar ranking to what they got the year before. So that, at least for Miller Coors, and I've tried to find this study published again. I wasn't able to find it online recently, but I remember reading it before. And that was enough for Miller Coors to conclude that terroir is a thing. And so they actually dropped that lowest drinkability growing area from their product and just continued with those top six.
Wow.
But yeah, it was just really cool to see that. And I mean, that was just seven different growing areas in that northern Great Plains area of the U.S. So you start getting malt from North Carolina, Tennessee. There are just some subtle differences there that, fortunately for us, are really good. So beer made with our malt has won gold medals nationally. Just recently, Legion Brewing out of Charlotte won gold for a beer made with our new roasted malt. And then silver medals globally. So, yeah, it's a good flavor. It's worth trying.
Yeah. So it sounds like there's different types of malts then?
Yeah. So we start with barley, which can be a fairly diverse product, even on the way in. And I mean, when I say that, like, just things like growing conditions can yield variability in things like the water sensitivity of the grain. So that's like how long it can stay underwater without drowning. And so that might be anywhere from 4 to 18 hours straight out of the field. So then we try to deal with that, deal with those differences coming into the malt house and put out a homogenous product. But there are different types of malt. So like right now we're having a West Coast IPA, mm-hmm. and it actually says on the can it's made with pale malt, wheat malt, Munich malt, and Crystal 40. So those yes. are four different types of malt. And mm. pale and Munich would both be made from barley. Okay. And the main difference between a pale and a Munich comes in during the kilning process. Mm. So there are a couple of things you would manipulate during the kilning process to generate more color in a Munich. So that Munich malt would you'd see that. You'd see a large portion of Munich malt like in an Oktoberfest or a Marzen beer.
Yeah.
But things like, I mean, so Munich malt would tend to be higher in a compound called melanoidin, which gives the beer a little bit of an amber, more of an amber color.
Okay.
And is made from the reaction between an amino acid and a reducing sugar. Mm. So in order to generate melanoidin in that Munich malt, we would spend some time kilning in a range that's optimal for proteolytic enzyme activity to break down proteins into amino acids. And then okay. spend some time in a temperature range that's good for production of reducing sugars from starch. And then ramp it up to about 186 Fahrenheit, which is a good temperature range for the amino acid to react with the reducing sugar and make that melanoidin compound. So
it almost sounds like you had a degree in science in order to get into this.
But it's been really fun to learn all the biochemistry involved.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah. And then so also malted wheat in here. Yeah. So, I mean, we also, in addition to barley, so for your listeners who don't know, barley and wheat, very closely related. Mm-hmm. Like when you see a grain field, barley and wheat look very, very similar. The difference would be barley has like hairs growing on the little heads of grain that okay. you see out in the field.
Okay.
But yeah, so we can malt wheat. We can malt oats. With my third production line coming online later this year, we'll be able to malt rye.
Oh.
And then we've malted some corn. We've malted sorghum. So yeah, wide variety of things you can run through the malting process.
So if you do it for rye, would you be able to start making whiskey then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, and like single malt whiskey is made with mostly malted barley. True, so you can already get that. They're in Mount Pleasant. It's a whiskey prison down there in Mount Pleasant.
Okay.
Mount Pleasant. But yeah.
I have to try
Interesting.
That.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So,
but yeah, once we do rye, that'll be really popular, I think, with rye whiskey makers.
Right. Yeah.
For sure. So do you, you had mentioned before that there's like hundreds of local breweries. Do you mainly supply the breweries, or are you also supplying like distilleries and stuff?
We only have a couple of distilleries that work with us. Okay. And I won't go into my speculation about why the whiskey industry might not care so much about local ingredients, but yeah, we do have a couple that work with us.
Nice.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, we're always joking that I've had multiple people come to me and be like, so when are you guys going to have your own whiskey out there? I was like, well, first off, that takes a minimum of 2 years.
Right.
So we got to get, we're only at 1 year together. We got to find it. We got to get all the things and source them before we can do that.
Of course, you can't always do what a lot of people do and just buy some pre-aged whiskey.
Right.
Slap
yeah.
your put label a logo on it. And I see you shaking your head, and I'm glad to see that.
Yeah.
There's a right way to do things.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. That's like walking into, like, I don't, there's businesses out there in general, besides outside of whiskey, where they're like, oh, hey, you know, I bought this company. And so, you know, this is what I'm selling. And I'm like, but you didn't really like go through all the growing pains, and you don't actually like connect to everybody. Like when people roll into a city and they're like, hey, guess what? This is our town. And like, no. The people have been here for years.
Something to be said about having that local product staying close, especially for these micro brews. It kind of like fits the story better. So I feel like that's probably more of your clientele anyway, right?
Right, right. Yeah, the smaller breweries.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're trying to grow and get our cost of production down and economies of scale. But, right. but yeah, a lot of the smaller breweries, I mean, they're selling their customers on local. And so if the ingredients are local, it's that much more local.
Yes.
Right. One of the reasons why I was interested in bringing you on too, and like something you don't hear a lot from breweries when you're going there, is they're not really talking about where they're getting their ingredients from.
Yeah.
It's like, I know if I would sit down, and probably Chris too, if they're like, hey, we have this new beer on tap, we got this malt from right down the road, and we got this hops from wherever. That story is so much more interesting to me now. And at the very least, like, let me try it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, we just had our harvest party last week where we try to get all the bartenders, servers to come out to the malt house and take them out to a barley field so they can have a picture of themselves with the barley that's going to turn into beer. And it's just trying to get that story, get the people who are actually serving the beer to understand that story and tell it to the customer.
Right.
It's something we work on a lot. But it really makes it better, though, when you know where it's from.
Yeah, it kind of goes along with the theme that we see a lot going on now, too, like the farm to table restaurants even. So like going from like a same
knowing exactly like where this farm was.
Yeah. Like, so like hey, farm to pint glass.
Yes.
That's all I was trying to think of.
I don't know if you've ever like been to one of those farm to table restaurants and you see on the menu, it's like, well, we do everything we can to source local. And then like you see the Cisco truck pulling out of the back.
Right.
But I mean, I feel like some of the, you know, local breweries are kind of, you know, you're going there and it's like, oh, it's a, you know, yeah, local brewery, but the malt's coming from the same place as the malt that's in any other, you know, any beer that you might import. So,
which is like, it explains so much why, like, even with microbreweries, there's a lot of them where the flavor is very similar. It's like, oh, hey, I'm drinking the same thing, but sometimes you can taste the difference. Like when we travel, we always try something random from like a local spot just for that reason. Like, can you tell the difference or did this guy say it's a local brewery and it just tastes like a Bud Light?
Have you been to St. Louis?
I've been. I haven't had a beer there.
I spent quite a bit of time in St. Louis and you would go around to all these places and you would drink it like, oh, we have this light beer. Like, oh, okay, whatever. Let me try it because that's the only thing they have there evidently. Mm-hmm. And you would try and you're like, kind of tastes like Bud Light. And you would start asking questions like, oh, who owns this brewery? And they're like, Anheuser-Busch. It's like, okay. It all makes sense now.
Now I see. But, I mean, Budweiser tastes, I would say, pretty good in Colorado, like in Fort Collins. Yeah, it's near the grain field.
Right.
Yeah, that's something I try to, you know, talk to my customers about is fresher is just better. I mean, beer, like any culinary product, the better ingredients, better beer.
Yeah.
Right.
So talking about better ingredients and better beer, because my brain is going through all these things. Where do you store all of your stuff? Like, cause when I think of a malt house, like the first thing I thought of was like co-works. I'm like, oh, it can't be that big. But then you're talking about like how much grains you have. And I'm like, this thing must be massive.
Yeah, so that's a great question. And yeah, people ask, like, well, you know, oh, well, should you just buy some malting machines? And it's like, well, no, they're too big to ship. There was no grain elevator around here that was stocking malting barley because there was absolutely no demand for it. So when we built our malt house, we had to simultaneously build a grain elevator on site.
Oh, wow.
So we located right in the middle of the grain belt, Cleveland, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And we built four large silos, each one capable of holding 34,000 bushels of barley.
Wow.
And so that's enough to keep us running for about a year and a half right now.
Okay.
And I held a meeting with local growers to ask them whether they could meet the quality that we wanted to see. And it turned out they could. I think there are 64 malt houses around the country. And we're at least fairly unique among them. I think there are only one or two others that built a grain elevator at the same time they were building their malt house. Even though there are these 64 craft malt houses around the country, a lot of the malt houses are like they're malting locally, but the grain is still coming from wherever they can get it.
Gotcha.
So every year in August, we contract with local growers to fill our silos in May. So. Nice. Yeah, actually, as I sit here today, I've probably when I go back tomorrow, I might have my first truckloads coming in. So,
that is awesome. For normal people who don't know anything about malt houses, what's a grain elevator?
Well, you see them sometimes when you're driving through the country, but it's like those great big round silvery cylinders with cones on top off the side of the road. Okay. And then there will be like some great big. There might be like a central column and there'll be pipes going down to all the different bins.
Okay.
And so that central column is really like the thing that elevates the grain, but then you call the whole thing is a grain elevator. with like all the storage is a grain elevator. Okay.
So it lifts it up and then drops it.
Yeah, lifts it up, drops it in a bin.
Okay.
That's the basics of it. So
I had both options in my head. I was like, it was either that or you built something that elevated your grain above the rest.
But yeah, we
that's just the process.
We had to build custom storage, though. Like most of the on-farm grain storage that you find in this area can't keep a high germination level through the summer. So it's just too hot and humid in the summer.
Oh, for sure.
Germination drops. So we custom built our grain bins to be able to keep that germination potential high through the summer. Oh, hmm. That was just another little thing we did to make it work in this area.
Was there a lot of trial and error when it came to that? Or like, did you know a lot of these things were going to pop up and you tried to hedge against them?
It was a lot of research that fortunately paid off.
Okay, good.
So, yeah. Very, very educated guesses.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, we had one farmer try to store some malting barley through the summer. And we need 99% germination to really put out the quality we want to put out. And that barley was down to 7% germination after one summer.
Oh my goodness. So
it's just that a lot of the bins in this area, or at least in our area, are the idea is just to store feed. And it doesn't matter if it pre-sprouts. So yeah, we just had to change our design a little bit. Yeah. It worked out. We've been able to store barley through two summers and maintain quality.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah.
So how long have you been in business then?
Well, let's see. It was 2014 that I quit my law job. 2015, I bought the grassy field where I built the place.
Oh, yeah.
It was like November 2015. I was able to hop on a bulldozer and start grading it out. And then it was March 2018 that we got our first commercial batch out.
Oh, wow.
So those were two busy years.
I'm sure. Yeah.
But we built the main structure, built the grain elevator, and then built the malting machinery inside the structure.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah. So you are a very smart man. I'll just put it out there.
That's nice of you to say. You're a very kind man. Oh, thank you.
That's what I want people to think.
Right.
So in your business, I've realized that you can't run everything by yourself, especially an operation this big. So who have you surrounded yourself with, like, within the malt house?
Well, you know, a lot of people who have just turned out to be totally key to the operation just kind of showed up along the way. My head maltster is Mark Van Wagenberg, guy that I grew up with in Salisbury. He heard what I was doing, and he had kind of an office job like I had before that.
Yeah.
And I think he wanted to do something similar. And so he came along. I mean, he's just been invaluable. He's my head maltster now. I hired a couple of guys off of the farms that I work with.
Oh, yeah.
Really good ingenuity in farm hands.
Like, right.
They're used to fixing machinery. So, yep. And that's a big part of the job out there. And so, yeah, a couple of those guys hired another person that I'd worked with for a long time, Chad. And then for bagging the grain at the end of the process, we've got a couple of high school kids who come in after school and fill bags of grain for a couple hours and go back home. So
yeah, that's perfect.
But yeah, I've really lucked out. I've only had to give the, you know, we're letting you go speech, I think like 5 or 6 times over the years.
Yeah.
So yeah.
That's fantastic for as long as you've been.
Yeah. Nobody enjoys that one.
No.
So
sorry, I really asked that question to figure out who was the person like actually there, like looking over, like when you were trying to figure out the temperatures and malting and transitioning, and you gave it to me. I just didn't know what the right question was, but I figured I would find it out.
You got there that way. So what was one of the biggest obstacles you had to overcome to get it up and running and as successful as you are?
Oh boy. There have been a lot.
I can imagine.
I mean, just what stands out to me is just the, it's difficult. There's always a reason not to keep progressing towards your goal.
Right.
And the thing that really just stands out to me, I've got a picture of myself on a day. It was like 50 degrees out, and I'm standing knee deep in just this mud water. It was back when we were grading out the field for the malt house. And like, I remember the mud was up to my ankles anyway, but it was like, we couldn't do any grading, but it was like, okay, well, what can I do today? Yeah. And so I needed to set some locations like for the corner of the building, stuff like that. And what I could do was set some stakes at the edge of the pond and then triangulate locations off of those and just wade out in the water and work on that. So, yeah, I mean, there's always, you know, you can always say like, oh, it's raining, I can't do anything today. But if you think about it, you can plan or you can, there's something you can do to keep it moving forward.
Yeah. Which is, it's weird because I feel like there's a lot of people who don't think that way in general because they're like, oh, well, this woe is me. This happened. I can't do this.
Maybe God doesn't want me to do this.
Yeah. You know? Right. Yeah. It's like, but really, I'm pretty sure it was just there to see how much you wanted to do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, so. I like that because we had somebody the other day, they were like, oh, I don't have anything, so I can't do anything today at my other job. And I'm like, or there's no customers here, so why don't you call these people or do this or do some training? You know, there's always ways to like further yourself.
Oh, yeah. I didn't have a bathroom at the malt house for about 6 months. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, like you can find ways.
Oh, yeah.
It's like,
well, since we went with the obstacles, I'm going to steal one of Chris's questions. And what would you define success as then?
Oh, boy. That's a tough one.
Either for yourself or the business, either one.
Yeah. Well, so I've got kids. I tell them Bible story, and your question made me think of this. So, like a few nights ago, I asked them, like, "Well, okay, well, what was the first commandment?" And they told me like the first of the Ten Commandments. And I said, "No, like the first commandment." And it was, you know, "Don't eat this fruit." But we screwed that one up. So then the next commandment was, "All right, you've been kicked out of the Garden of Eden. Now you must work and eat of the soil." And so, you know, hard work, like I hope to get to the end of my life and find that, you know, I've worked enough, but it's not enough to just work hard. Like your work has to bear fruit. So just seeing the fruit of my work, which is this malt, you know, in you guys' hands and in the hands of so many people enjoying it, you know, that feels really good. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of success for me is seeing people drink my beer. Well, beer made from my malt.
Right.
I mean, you could go back and start making beer if you wanted to.
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be a lot of fun, but I've got so many people doing that for me right now.
Right. Yeah.
It's just great.
Exactly.
See, he's smart. He's like, I'm not going to, you know, I could open up a brewery, but wouldn't it be easier to just supply?
Oh, I don't know about easier. You were calling me smart earlier. I think there are a lot of people who would look at, you know, wow, he's worked too hard, but it's been fun. I mean, I've really enjoyed every step along the way. Like it's starting out a lot of fun. Like when I quit my job, I just started touring malt houses all over the world.
Wow.
So I took trips to, you know, Scotland, the UK, Germany, Canada, and just tried to tour malt houses wherever I went and bring back the ideas. But yeah, the world tour part of it was pretty great.
Yeah. That sounds like a lot of fun. What was your favorite one to visit?
Oh boy. You know, it not so much relevant for building this malt house, but very traditional old malt houses on Isla in Scotland.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So like if you get, yeah, I mean, you guys are into whiskey. So you've had like Lefroy, Glagavulin, Ardbeg. Yeah. So all those distilleries are on that one island over here off Scotland. And boy, is it beautiful. But yeah, it's traditional malt houses. So like my malting machinery is pneumatic malting machinery. Mm-hmm. So that's what I designed and built. But over there, I mean, they're still malting the way it's been done for thousands and thousands of years. So like there's archaeologists have recovered an ode to the Mesopotamian beer goddess Ninkazi that contains an early malting recipe.
I didn't even know that existed.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, it's from like 1800 BC, they think. But back then they would hydrate the malt, but they would spread it out like 6 inches deep on a big stone floor. Mm-hmm. And then they would actually hydrate and drain on the schedule with the tides. So like there's this voice and the verse in the poem, it's like the tides come in, the tides go out. And that's like hydrating the grain, draining the grain. So at these malt houses in Scotland, they're still doing floor malting. So it's like 6 inches deep on this big concrete floor.
Wow.
And they're dragging a rake through it to keep the rootlets from binding.
Yeah.
But yeah, at our operation, I've got a big helical grain turner machine that takes care of that for me.
Yeah.
But still really cool over there. And then for the kilning process. So I use propane, indirect fired propane.
Yeah.
Over there, they dig peat from the peat bogs and burn that. And they were so nice. They let me tour and like put my hand into the peat oven and stuff like that. Oh,
that's cool.
Feel the smoke moving around my hand. Yeah, it was really cool to see that.
Can you use that malt for beer then too? Or are there beers that taste peaty?
You could. I don't think they've been popular.
I was going to say, I've never had one and it doesn't sound great. So that answers my question.
But it makes sense for scotch.
Oh, it works well.
Right.
Yeah. It works great for scotch. Yeah.
I was just curious if there was something out there.
No. I'm one for trying almost anything.
That is not one of them.
No, it's not.
I bet you could find one in the UK somewhere.
Yeah.
There's that one brewery over there that made the beers where they like taxidermied animals around the outside of the beer. So it looks like you're kissing a squirrel or whatever. When they have
one
fun.
Of those has to be Petey.
They have fun over
there. See, I mean, by year seven, someone will be, sponsoring us and we'll do a tour.
Sweet.
And we'll hit that. And I'm like, hey, we'll reach out. I'm like, hey, you said some random places in the UK. Where should we try?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. Hit me up. I'll come with you.
Sounds good. Yeah.
Yeah. You take a ferry over to Scotland or over to Isla.
Right. Yeah.
Mainland Scotland. Yeah. It's just really beautiful.
It's one of those things. I'm just so jealous. My family's been to London like a handful of times now, but they're like, cause London, there's just so much to do there.
Oh yeah.
In my head, I'm like, but do I really want to be in London or do I want to explore everything around London that involves alcohol?
Right.
I'm not an alcoholic, I promise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sam Smith Brewery over there is worth a visit too.
He has one.
Yeah. So, there's a singer named Sam Smith. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Well, the original Sam Smith.
Not his.
Yeah. It's over in, I'm sure I'm going to butcher this pronunciation because they
everything's
Gloucester is spelled Gloucester.
Right.
Anyway, to me, it looks like it's spelled Tadcaster, but it's over there in the UK. But one of only two breweries in the world where their fermenters are made out of stone.
Oh, wow.
So most breweries use stainless steel fermenters, but stone fermenters over there. Yeah, really nice flavor. Worth a visit.
Yeah, so. I have to put that on the list.
In my head, I'm like, I feel like stone would give it a really different flavor. But it's very hard to find something that you could like seal like that
and
clean.
Yeah, yeah. And they make epoxies for it. Mm-hmm. But yeah. And then since it's stone, the fermenters are square instead of round.
Okay.
And then they have, I can't remember if it's bronze or brass, but everything's held together with brass fittings or bronze, maybe. But yeah.
It seems so fancy.
Oh, and it's really cool though. I think it's another one of those things where it's just like, well, you just have to taste it and see if you taste a difference.
Yeah.
But I like to think the stone probably keeps more of the mineral content in the beer. Maybe makes it taste a little sweeter.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Do they ship anything over from like Europe over to the US or is that completely just?
Beer?
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. You can find it in a lot of places.
Okay.
Yeah. If you ever get a chance, try to look for a Sam Smith Stingo. But yeah, it's like a barrel aged. Good stuff.
Can you find that in the U.S.?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, if you go to a bottle shop and try to order it, I mean, it's not made with my malt. So really, if you go to a bottle shop, you should, ask them they have. It's made with Carolina malt. I mean, that's what you really want. Yeah. That's the really good stuff.
Yeah.
But still, the stone fermenters are pretty cool.
Yeah.
So combining multiple things on your website, because you used to work with websites and development and everything, does it showcase the breweries that use your malt?
We try to. It's kind of a lot to keep up with. Okay. But there is a page on our website you can go to and like it's organized by city. You can see what breweries in each city. But we're working on getting better at that. I've got a couple of people tasked to that right now.
Right.
So hopefully in a few years in a few months you can see like a Google Maps with little pins for we're working toward that.
One of Chris's short term goals is opening a bottle shop. So when we'll make it short. So when he opens his bottle shop as the expert, what type of beer should he be looking for malt wise that he should keep in his bottle shop for the best flavor? of course it's your malt, but like what are the type of like malts that he's looking for?
Well, so you've got the base malts. I mean, you already said, obviously it's my malt. That's the best malt.
Right.
but I mean, like I say, I kind of keep going back to freshness matters. And then when we make malt, I mean, we're trying to fit one of those industry standard malt profiles. So there are four base malts. So there's Pilsner, Pale, Vienna, Munich. So we're trying to make a malt that matches the numbers that a brewery expects to see. So when I say numbers, I mean efficiency in terms of how much sugar it contributes to alcohol production,
right?
Okay. Color, free amino nitrogen, protein level, amylase enzyme level, things like that. So we're trying to produce a malt that fits this industry standard spec, but is just fresher and has that local flavor.
Yeah.
So when you say what kind of malt, I mean, the brewer then, like the brewer's recipe would typically involve selecting from among these industry standard malt specs and just combining them in certain ratios and then changing and then mashing at different temperatures to bring out different compounds from the different malts that they're using.
Okay.
And then
that makes sense. Is there a flagship malt that either you have or you would like to make that's different than the industry standard, or the industry is old enough that they have their standard down? There's no messing with it.
I mean, every once in a while, a malt house comes out with, like, they say, oh, we have this new malt. Like, I think there's a malt house offering like honey malt. It was a German malt that had previously been called brew malt. But it has kind of it contributes a little bit of honey flavor. So then they said, oh, well, we're going to call it honey malt. But yeah, I mean, that kind of stuff happens. But really, I mean, those four base malts kind of give you the main flavor chemicals that you can get out of the process.
Okay.
And so now roasting is a whole different animal. So this beer that we're drinking has Crystal 40 in it.
Yeah.
And that's a malt where you put it in the roaster and you cause the starch to break down into sugar and then crystallize a little bit. Before it ever goes to the brew house. So all kinds of interesting things you can do with a roaster. And we just got our roaster running last year, so we can now do roasted barley, biscuit malt, and we're working on our recipes. We want to make sure it's all perfect before it goes out. But yeah, I mean, so like if you ever drink a porter or a stout, I mean, that would have roasted barley or chocolate malt or black patent or something like that.
Okay.
So yeah, that's where that color in the beer comes from.
We're going to have to bring a master brewer on here now.
Yes.
This has opened up so many other questions on the back end of the malting process.
Oh, cool. You should. Yeah. I mean, there's so much to it, but it's a lot of fun. What was your, when do you ask me? Oh, what kind of malt should you look for? Those four base malts, Pilsner, Pale, Vienna, Munich. I mean, that's kind of what the main malting machinery turns out. And then you can start with those base malts and roast to achieve different specs from there.
Okay. So. What's your favorite style beer then?
Oh, I can't pick one. like Chris was observing earlier, like you've got your springtime beers and your summertime beers and your wintertime beers. But no, I really love a good light lager.
Okay.
I can't name a favorite on the podcast.
So, very true. So along with this bottle shop that I've looked into slightly out of the corner of my eye, I also really like ciders, even though they're super sweet and will probably give me a horrible hangover.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys apply any cideries with malt?
Well, I mean, I don't know if, I mean, you certainly could make like a blended cider beer, but typically cider doesn't have malt in it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you can try.
Yeah. Might be good.
I'm trying to see if somebody's out there already taking my ideas as per usual.
Yep. Now that you said it, someone's going to try it if they haven't already.
I'm sure they have.
I know our customer, Yeehaw, they do a fair amount of cider. And I don't know if they do any blended cider beer type of thing. But it would be interesting to find out.
Ask Bull City.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Figure it out.
But yeah, the bottle shop idea. Cool idea. You should do it.
See?
Problem is I have a way of living currently, and opening a bottle shop would not be conducive to that living right now. It would be like a lot of my savings just
Well, it's worked out. So just saying.
True. Yeah.
We are starting to come up on time though, so I have a couple more questions. I guess the big question is, if you were to tell your younger self one thing, what would it be?
Well, you did a good job, buddy. You know, but appreciate all the attention to studying and playing sports. You know, that really paid off. Thanks. I feel like you set me up pretty well.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. That was probably one of the best responses to it.
Yes. Yeah. I'm like, I didn't get nothing on that.
Don't be so mad at mom for making you clean your room. It's important.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like that. But on a normal note, now that we, like I said, I like going in the past to jump forward. Where can people like follow your story or like as your brand grows and whatnot?
So we're okay. So my focus until this year has been build the machines, make them as efficient as possible, try to get cost of production down. And then this year I'm finally trying to make sure that people who drink our beer, because I mean, up to this year, I think maybe 1% of the people who have drunk a beer with Carolina malt in it actually knew that fact.
Right.
So this year I really want to try to get it out. So we've got a Facebook page, Instagram page. And we've got this hashtag spread the malt, okay. Which I'm not a social media person, so I don't exactly know what that implies, but yeah, hashtag spread the malt. I was told to say that. But yeah, Facebook, Instagram, and then I know there's some other. Oh, there's LinkedIn. That's a thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. So we're trying to kind of get the word out through those channels and by talking to people like you.
Yeah.
So thanks for having me down.
Absolutely. So probably searching for Carolina Malt House. Is that right?
Yeah, Carolina Malt House or that spread the malt hashtag. I think we've only started on that like a month ago. So
okay.
But yeah. Carolina Malt House. Check us out, please.
We know the importance of finding a good social media team, too. We actually partnered up with, they're actually closer to where you are than us, but it's called Sway Creations, and they've taken over almost all of our social media now. So
it
looks much better than what it did before and everything.
Yes.
Nice. And I actually do have another shout out for this month that I didn't tell Chris about, but for the Cargo District, Clear Vision Auto Glass. Mm-hmm. There was a rock that went into my windshield and shattered my windshield, and they were able to get me up and running and safe again and no problem at all. So if anyone has a horrible incident like I did with rocks going through your windshield, go to Clear Vision Auto Glass and they'll work with your insurance and get you all set up and ready to go. So big shout out to them.
Don't ride too close.
I wasn't that close to the truck that rock shot out at me. Because I even thought about it, too. I was like, there's stuff coming off that truck. Let me get back a little bit further. And then, like, 30 seconds after that, boom. Sure enough.
Yeah. You probably just got right in the zone for the second bounce to catch
yep.
you. Know,
yeah.
Like, you were out of danger and then, yeah.
But, like,
exactly.
People don't realize how far 200 feet is. Like, the back of those dump trucks, like, stay back 200 feet. And I'm like, eh.
That's most of a football field.
Right.
Yeah. And no one's going to be that far away from a truck.
Nope.
I can't pass you. I can't do anything. So imagine that on a one-way, like on a two-lane highway, if you actually stayed back. I'd be so mad at life.
Oh, yeah. 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 Impractical warnings.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah.
But it's very good if you're a lawyer.
Right.
But thank you. I just want to thank you so much for popping on here.
Thanks for having me down. I really appreciate the chance to talk a little bit about the Malt House. And yeah, I just trying to make sure people understand that option to get a locally grown beer.
Yeah, that's great. I'll definitely be asking more and asking even more questions to the bartenders at the breweries now. So they'll be looking forward to that.
Yes. Good.
Where did this come from?
We are definitely those people at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure my bartenders hate me because I sit there and I'm like, okay, so what is in this whiskey? Why do you have this drink on tap? And I just like to know, because if you spent all this time and hours learning this, you should use it for something.
It's funny. I mean, we've been in business for 5 years now, mm-hmm. But just it was late last year. I went to one of my best customers to eat dinner. And I said, hey, I heard you guys use locally grown malt in your beer. And the server was like, I don't know.
Maybe.
And so, I called up their owner and said, like, you know, hey, you guys are, you know, you got to let your customers know. Like, and so we invited got them to bring their whole front of house staff out to the malt house. And so we try to be zero waste. Like all of our malt waste goes to a farm up the road to feed pigs and chickens. And so we got a pork tenderloin from one of those pigs that was fed on malt waste, cooked that up for the for his whole team. I gave him a tour of the place, got him on the zip line, the swing, the blueberry patch, all that.
But you have all that at your malt house?
You guys got to come up.
I was saying, now we have.
Oh, it's a true experience.
Here, but like, I mean, 2 weeks the blueberries will be ripe. You got to come up.
Oh yeah, sold on that.
But yeah, and so got them out, and then they go back, and then they can tell the customer about it. You know, like that. That's just the whole. We just have to stay on top of that. Like, you know, there's turnover in the industry, but we just gotta stay
of
on
course,
it.
Yeah,
bring them up. Yeah, yeah.
That's it.
But yeah, I just want to say, yeah, thank you for driving down here. We will definitely try and schedule something with our ridiculous schedules to come up there. I love that area. I've still never been to Lake Norman, but
oh really.
I've been to Charlotte and Hickory area a lot.
Driven through it all the time.
Yeah.
Oh,
never,
yeah.
Never to the lake.
Lake Norman's great. I mean, yeah. Come up, see the malt house, rent a pontoon boat, just have yourself a great little weekend.
Might have to do that.
Yep. Sold.
Yeah. Thank you guys for listening, though. It's been a blast trying out this silly goose. No,
silly
island.
Goose.
Sneaky goose. I'm used to saying like silly goose to kids. Trying out the sneaky goose from Wilmington Brewing Company that actually uses some malt from Carolina Malt House.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you guys should check it out. Or check out the one that has a little bit more of their malt if it ever comes back in stock.
Fingers crossed.
There you go. But yeah, like, comment, share, subscribe. Leave us a nice review on social media if you can because it helps the algorithm. And we want to go to the top. 10% of podcast.
And even if you don't have something nice to say, you can put it on our YouTube because that's new and I'll take any of the social media. It's possible. So put your comments there.
Yeah. For those who like YouTube, we have one now. So yeah, check it out.
Yep.
Thank you guys. Really appreciate the chance to be on.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers.